Hi, everybody. This is Micha Tifri with Personal Democracy Forum, and welcome back to the PDF Network and our regular series of ongoing conference calls with innovators and movers and shakers in the technology and politics arena. As always, I want to thank our sponsors, AT&T and the Bivings Group, for helping make these calls possible. Today, I'm very excited to be joined by Cheryl Conti, who's been a friend for a number of years, working in a variety of places along the spectrum of online organizing and politics. And Cheryl is today one of the partners in Fission Strategy, which is a small consultancy that maybe she'll tell you a little bit more about, the kind of work that they do, and also one of the founders and chief bloggers behind Jack and Jill, which as a blog is kind of a leading voice in the African-American community online. And it's really a treat to have her today because we're going to roll up our sleeves and sort of do a deep dive into looking at how African-American participation is changing online. There have been some really interesting developments over the last few years, some of which relate to how the nature of the digital divide is changing and to some degree is narrowing, and also the effect of President Obama, the Obama campaign, drawing lots of new people into the process and kind of bringing a lot of African Americans into online politicking and participating in much more robust ways than we've seen in the past. So, as always, what we're going to do is start the call off. I'm going to let Cheryl walk us through some very interesting slides that she's pulled together for us. So hopefully you can see those on your screen, but she'll also mention the highlights. There's some very good data here. And then she and I will talk back and forth maybe for the first half of the call, and then we'll open it up for folks who are listening. Of course, if at any time you have a question, you can use the chat, which is there available in the bottom corner of your ReadyTalk screen. And at the same time, we'll be looking at Twitter. Use the hashtag PDF Network, and that's another way to join in the conversation. So, Cheryl, real pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Micha. I'm so excited to speak with everyone today. Thanks for having me. Why don't we go to the next slide? So this is the original jackandchillpolitics.com site. We launched it in 2006 in the summer. Both of the founders launched the site as under pseudonyms. I was Jill Tubman, and Baratunde Thurston, who is web editor at The Onion now and also has his own TV show on the Science Network called Popular Sciences, Feature of. Both of us, he wrote as Jack Turner, actually. So, and that's common of a lot of black bloggers, particularly at this period. At the time, there were some well-known bloggers, particularly The Republic of Tea and Pam Houseland, Pam Spalding, some of you may know her. They were very popular. At the same time, you know, they were a small group, and there was a lot of pressure to have more black bloggers. And, you know, I was encouraged by some of the bloggers with whom I was working as a consultant to start blogging. And the positioning that we had for Jack and Jill Politics was very much oriented towards representing the black middle class. And the tagline for our blog has always been Jack and Jill Politics offers a black bourgeoisie perspective on American politics. Our reasoning was that the black middle class is seldom seen in American media and seldom referenced by politicians. Usually you see African Americans, especially at that time, as either criminals or the urban poor or wealthy people, such as, you know, the Housewives of Atlanta or Oprah or sports stars, Michael Jordan. So mm-hmm. we wanted to represent the majority of African Americans who are taxpaying, you know, law-abiding, you know, and citizens who happen to be very interested in politics and actually represent an economy and a sort of a committed policy side of France within the United States. And this was controversial. As soon as we started blogging, we started getting a lot of attention. And we were also, you know, grateful to enjoy some support, not only from large progressive blogs, but also from some emerging organizations like Color of Change and Hip Hop Caucus, with whom we partnered. So we stepped into this growing, you know, very nascent blogosphere, started making some noise. You know, our goals were to challenge media perceptions of African Americans, to hold Black leaders accountable, and to also push for better representation of, you know, the real African American viewpoint. So let's go to the next slide.
Mm-hmm.
This is Jack and Jill Politics today, and we relaunched the site sometime before the election happened, knowing that during the primary season and beyond that we would receive even more attention. We've been lucky. Let's go to the next slide. We've been fortunate to be a part of some exciting and really challenging protests online, and that has been successful, such as Gina Six, probably one of the most famous. And how that happened really was that there were some initial, you know, small media stories, Black bloggers who had started to communicate amongst each other in the back channel, mostly over email, you know, caught a hold of the story and were very interested in it. We started blogging about it. We worked with Color of Change and a couple of other organizations. Meanwhile, we also started pushing on large organizations like the NAACP and the National Urban League, who were silent on the matter of the Gina Six, and saying, you know, where are you? The NAACP Legal Defense Fund at the time hadn't been updated in a couple of years, so their website, they had no press releases. So we really started to follow the case. We corrected media inaccuracies. We actually started pushing back on big progressive bloggers and saying, why aren't you covering this story? So it generated a lot of controversy. A very different tactic was the Congressional Black Caucus, where that was primarily Black bloggers working with Color of Change and then some other larger organizations, non-African American targeted NGOs like Move On, et cetera, to challenge African American legislators who were planning to vote for, to pass their superdelegate vote during the primaries for Hillary Clinton, even though 80 or 90% of their constituents had voted for Barack Obama in the primary. And then finally, a very different dynamic you can see in the Hillary Clinton racist attacks, where we really started to, along with a lot of other groups, you know, joining, you know, a wide, I think, progressive swath, started to hit on Hillary Clinton and her surrogates during the primary on, you know, what were, you know, very racially tinged often attacks on Barack Obama, a very similar strategy actually to what we have pursued with Glenn Beck and getting his advertisers to start to distance themselves from him. Let's go to the next slide.
Mm-hmm. Just tell us, by the way, how has your readership grown over those 3 years?
Well, it has grown and it has changed. I think in the early days, there was definitely a political insider audience that was early on very interested in the new perspective that we were offering. That included bloggers, media types, politicians, and government workers. Over time, a really strong community has developed that is often perceived as being majority African-American, but is actually probably about 30 to 50% non-African-American, which is interesting to us. We continue to talk to the audience and represent, our target audience. At the same time, we understand that, there is a real mix of people from all walks of life at, the top of the food chain to, ordinary Americans. And we have, experienced incredible growth at peak levels. Our page views have been 300,000 to 500,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been successful. We have blogged, both Eric Kinde and I, at both the Democratic National Convention and the inauguration by invitation. I actually was invited earlier this year in March to participate in the G20 summit as a blogger. We were the first bloggers ever invited to participate in the G20 or a G8 summit, and it was really exciting. And I'm not at this current one in Pittsburgh. I thought it might be of interest to people, what that was like. I met Sir Bob Geldof, who told me that he was a fan of Jack and Jill politics, which is crazy for me, as you can imagine. But it was really, exciting. I have continued to be surprised as to who's reading, and I never dreamed or imagined that we would have, I think the positive influence that we've had in a positive representation, and I think hopefully an accurate one of African American viewpoints. So let's go to the next slide.
Okay.
So there's a Pew Internet report that recently came out that talked about the changing digital divide, and what you see here is the traditional view that I think many have of how African Americans and Hispanics are using the internet, and sort of what you can see is clearly a lag, particularly for African Americans. Hispanics have more or less erased that gap or exceed white usage in many cases. It should be clear, though, that for these numbers for Hispanics are English-speaking Hispanics only. When you add in Spanish-speaking Hispanics, it's not in the survey, but I've seen other surveys that are similar. These numbers, their numbers tend to approach the African-American numbers for traditional internet access. Let's go to the next slide. When you actually look at wireless or mobile use, the next slide shows this. You actually see that African Americans and Hispanics are 5 to 10 points ahead of whites in terms of their use of wireless internet, and in terms of their use of data and mobile internet, it's almost 20 points ahead in some cases. When you add in mobile use, the digital divide starts to collapse. And, Jack and Jill Politics, I think, stepped into the sphere at the very moment in which a lot of African Americans were starting to leapfrog and bypass some of the traditional uses and ways of accessing the internet. And what we actually see is that African Americans and Hispanics are actually using the internet in different ways and often in more advanced ways than many whites. Let's go to the next slide.
Mm-hmm.
And this snapshot just shows a graph of digital activities for those who are either online or cell phone users. And what you see there is that the total digital activities, the digital divide, completely is erased. And in fact, English-speaking Hispanics, per day, I mean, they actually, you know, use the internet much, much more. So, you know, I think it's an exciting time where the playing field is being leveled online, and yet, you know, there are some challenges with that. Let's go to the next slide. This is part of, you know, a trend that, you know, those who have been watching, you know, the numbers over time have seen. The slide currently shows some numbers from the second quarter of 2006 and the number of mobile video users versus total mobile subscribers. And, you know, even then you could see that African Americans as a percentage of, you know, mobile video users versus mobile subscribers, you know, were using it at, you know, in some cases, you know, the percentage, twice the number, you know, versus their actual percentage of, you know, per capita use. So, you know, this is a trend that has actually been happening over time, and I think that Jack and Jill was just, you know, well positioned, you know, to take advantage of, you know, and be a part of and of a surge happening in our society. Let's go to the next slide. What that looks like is that most African Americans who have a college degree are online. And what we're seeing, you know, is that the digital divide has changed. It's no longer along ethnic lines, it's along education and income lines. You know, because of the legacy of discrimination in this country, of course, you know, that does, you know, tend to skew the numbers still, you know, ethnically. At the same time, you know, what we see today is that 38% of general consumers and 34% of African American users, the same, have paid their monthly bills online recently, right? I mean, those numbers are, you know, exactly the same. For both African Americans and the general market population, you know, they have internet access in some way, right? What we saw during the election, this is from another Pew study that was done right after the primaries, 40% of white African Americans and a slightly higher number for Hispanics went online to find news and political information. The same number, mm-hmm. Right? And yet, you know, when you think of, you know, those numbers, you know, you really start to see that, you know, there's a shift in, you know, the power of people who before were disconnected, potentially, you know, weren't able to communicate effectively or organize, and, you know, some new ways now emerging, including My Barack Obama, that turned out to be very successful. Let's go to the next slide. Again, there are a lot of numbers on these slides. I think, you know, the one that's really interesting here is at the bottom, where, you know, Hispanics are more likely than whites not only to use instant messaging, internet TV, mobile internet, blogs, but they're also more likely to use all of those at the same time. You know, the way that they use the internet is very different, and I think that that's really interesting. So let's go to the next slide. This is How to Find Me After This. Jack and Jill Politics is something that, like I would say just about all African American bloggers, is something that I do as a labor of love. It's not something that I earn any money at, really. You know, this is a case, I think, for a lot of folks. And I think what's important to understand about African American bloggers and the digerati is that often, you know, like me, they are fairly sophisticated users of the internet in their daily lives, and that this was one way in which they were able to communicate. I think it's one reason why we see Black Planet as, you know, one of the largest social networks in the world. It's a little known fact, but it's almost always in the top 5 or top 10 when you actually look at a ranking of global social networks. So I think it's important not to underestimate this audience. For those who are interested in what I do when I'm not doing Jack and Jill Politics, as Micha mentioned, I am the co-founder of Vision Strategy, which is an social media and online consulting firm that provides innovative techniques for nonprofits and foundations. And some of our clients include Move On, Moms Rising, the American Cancer Society, Alliance for Climate Protection, ACLU, I could go on. So, Micha, I'll turn it over to you.
Sure. So I have a couple of questions. I want to first just go, thank you. That is a great overview and really interesting and hopefully challenging some folks' assumptions about the contours of African Americans online. One question, though, I just sort of want to get this out of the way. If we go back into the slides where you talk about mobile usage, and you know, to a lot of people, the first thought is, well, but isn't that you know, people using their mobile maybe just for text messaging? It's pretty expensive to have a smartphone with a data plan. Are you saying that these numbers show African Americans and Hispanics are high-end users of mobile, or are, you know, primarily texting? How should we interpret that?
Well, the study actually does discriminate. I mean, between data, which is SMS, versus mobile internet. And, yes, African Americans, for, again, reasons that we're still, I think, trying to understand, but I think it has a lot to do with leapfrogging, which is a sort of a technical term whereby groups that are endeavoring, that may have lagged behind technologically, start to, attempt to, move ahead more quickly and therefore go for, what's the latest rather than going through, they don't go through, ISDN and dial-up,
sure,
and the broadband. They just go straight to, I can get, the cell phone, and I need a cell phone, and it also has the internet, right?
Right, but not every cell phone does have the internet. What these numbers are suggesting is mobile internet use or handheld data use by blacks and Hispanics is definitely somewhere in the range of, 7 to 15, 20 points higher, depending on which measure you look, significantly higher than whites. And that is, definitely a counterintuitive notion to people who believe the digital divide is basically, who has access to the high-speed internet, who doesn't, and it comes down to money. So the key concept here is this idea of leapfrogging of people who are entering the marketplace and just deciding to jump ahead and pay a little bit more, but maybe they don't have broadband at home, right?
Right, exactly. And I think it also has something to do with the changing demographics. When you look at, younger people, 45 or 35 and under, it's a much more diverse population. So,
mm-hmm.
It's going to skew towards, younger people who are much more, savvy with, using, an iPhone or a PDA. And even today, I know because I had to use a really crappy cell phone for a while. Even the crappiest, cell phones now often have mobile internet. It can be difficult to use it, but it is usable. I think that, what we're finding is that, in part, because of the changing demographics, we're seeing, things really move around, I think, much more quickly than we anticipated.
Right. So I want to ask you one other question about, just to reflect back on Jack and Jill politics and its evolution, and then we'll sort of shift to how do people take sort of best engage this constituency online. But you talked about starting out with pseudonyms and then eventually opening up and writing in your own names. And when you and I were talking before this call, I brought up a piece that Spencer Overton had written for Tech President about 2 years ago. Spencer, at the time, one of the lead bloggers at blackprofs.com, a group of black professors. And he wrote about how in the African-American community it was his experience that a lot of political conversation was done via email and listserv rather than people networking on social networking platforms. And that part of the reason for that was sort of a desire to keep things inside the family, right? Certain conversations that were best not being that visible, people felt more comfortable having an email because at least you know who the email is going to, presumably, where a social network profile or whatever is more open. Now, does that track with your own experience? Do you think, there are all kinds of reasons that somebody would want to protect themselves from a level of visibility online. There's a lot of nastiness on the web, and I can see why that would be a choice to write under a pseudonym as one reason. But what about Spencer's point? I mean, is there a level of political engagement and conversation for African Americans that is basically, it's an inside conversation, or is that changing? What do you think?
I think the internet has offered a different way for people to communicate. In the past, you know, there was the kitchen table, you know, and I think a lot of Black families will tell you that they grew up talking about, very sophisticated issues, in the news, at home, at the kitchen table. At the same time, there's the beauty shop and the barber shop, which were the classic kind of community hubs. And, as the, internet, grew in use, sure, email and listservs, I think, provided that sort of privacy just amongst ourselves, the online barbershop, the online beauty shop. So, some Black bloggers started to come on the scene, actually in the beginning, a lot of them, like Pam Spalding, and, Terrence of
Republic of C.
Yeah, those were, Black gay bloggers. They were people who were already somewhat, outside the mainstream of African-American opinion. And so, they had already taken some brave steps in their lives. For, African-Americans, from the mainstream to, come out and actually have a public discussion about, what African-Americans think or don't think, was, I think, a pretty big deal, which is why you see, many of them, like us, starting with pseudonyms, because there was a fear of, what might be the repercussions. What if, these, opinions are unpopular or, someone, who would hire us, might not like those opinions.
Mm-hmm.
It became clear, though, that, society has changed and that, people were actually not only interested but eager in, getting the truth. What is it that, African-American mainstream, consumers and voters really think about this issue? It wasn't mm-hmm. something that the media was interested at all, prior to the Obama candidacy, showcasing. I think now, in the wake of, Obama election, you've got, I think the number of Black commentaries and commentators in the media has, multiplied by many, many times, which is pretty mm-hmm. exciting. Before, I remember when, one of the big points that we made in Jack and Jill was, it's not just about Al Sharpton and it's not just about Jesse Jackson. We actually make fun of them on a regular basis in the Black community.
Mm-hmm.
So, things have really changed, since that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, one thing that's very familiar in describing how, you in particular and other Black bloggers have built an audience, built community, is really through actions, through picking flashpoints, moments when you could drive attention or fill a vacuum. Right, and that's familiar, I think, to anybody who does online organizing. They'll tell you you have to look for those opportunities to kind of step in and provide a service that otherwise, isn't being provided, and very often it's around, some cause, some issue that's otherwise being neglected. That's pretty I think that's pretty much true. But would you say, I mean, you mentioned Black Planet as a very big online hub for African Americans and beyond America, actually. Is it, I mean, would you draw a comparison to the way people use Facebook or MySpace to try and do organizing around causes to what goes on Black Planet? I mean, do you think a lot of people have pointed to the big social network sites as places where people are, you know, mostly socializing with their friends or trying to meet people, but where causes and political issues are just part of the background noise. And would you say that the same dynamic is really accessible there? And what evidence, you know, can you give us some examples of how people have used a site like Black Planet to do online organizing of African Americans?
Sure. Well, you know, I can't give you a lot of examples because I think Black Planet has largely been ignored by a lot of people as a place, and, you know, for reasons that, you know, I don't pretend to understand. I think that, you know, there's a lot going on Facebook that isn't cause related. You know, I use it to keep in touch with my family and friends, but I use it for a lot of other things, too, and I think that's true of a lot of people. For Black Planet, you know, we've seen a lot of the same issues that we talk about on Jack and Jill often get mirrored on Black Planet, particularly around the election. There was a lot of organizing, a lot of discussion. The political debates happen all the time on Black Planet, people share links to, you know, our site, to other sites, to, you know, places where, you know, they can, you know, actually do something about what they've seen in the news.
Are there any affordances or vehicles on Black Planet the way, you know, for example, Facebook has Facebook Causes, anybody can build an app that, you know, can run on Facebook, which makes it, I mean, like the Obama campaign built themselves an app to run on Facebook. Does Black Planet make itself as useful an environment for those kinds of things, or it's more rudimentary?
Yeah, I wouldn't say, yeah, it's not necessarily as much about apps. It's more of, I think, a sharing. It's, I think, more structured than MySpace, but I think it has, you know, a lot of similarities in terms of, you know, that a very freewheeling environment that can be a challenge to navigate, you know, if you're not sort of part of the culture. So, you know, I think it does offer challenges, but I think, you know, for those who are interested, you know, Black Planet isn't going away. It was actually purchased last year by TV1, which is owned by, by Kathy Hughes, who's, you know, one of the wealthiest Black people in America, and owns, you know, a TV and before that a radio conglomerate. So, you know, I think that, you know, there are some, you know, people who are, you know, see Black Planet and other places like it, Mi Gente, and Asian Avenue, for example, as, you know, growth for the future.
Right. Are there any, let's go back to the mobile space. And by the way, I want to say we're just past the halfway point on the call. So folks who are listening, if you have a question, start formulating it in your heads or type it into the chat, but I'm going to open things up shortly. But let's talk about mobile, and is there anybody doing anything in terms of political organizing using mobile platforms that you think is of special interest to folks who are trying to develop relationships or build a base among African Americans? Anything you want to point us to?
In terms of African Americans, you know, I don't know that anyone is doing a great job. I think the, you know, Obama campaign, again, did an incredible job during the election and has continued to try to work that. We are working, actually, with the largest immigration coalition, which is called Reform Immigration for America. And we have built we have two mobile action networks. One called Justicia, which is in Spanish, and one called Justice. And it's now over 50,000, and most of those are on the Spanish language site. And that has happened within only a couple of months. So I think that, you know, what we are seeing are, you know, some folks, I mean, using mobile for organizing in the United States is still challenging, you know, just because of the you know, the new rules and regulations, and, you know, the carrier network challenges. At the same time, I think that we're going to, you know, see mobile increasingly become important, and some of the technical challenges that we have today will start to get ironed out.
But I think what one of the takeaways I'm getting from our conversation is that if you're an organization that's investing a lot of your resources now on your website and even your web outreach, you're making a big mistake if you aren't also creating a mobile version of your site and also thinking about mobile video. Right? Those are like two big takeaways from the numbers you just shared with us.
Exactly. You know, I think, you know, mobile video is easy to do at this point. You know, just using YouTube can get you there often. In terms of, you know, creating a mobile site version of your site, I think just making sure that it's not mobile hostile, you know, at a minimum. You know, just making sure that, you know, check and see, you know, what is it like to pull up your web page on a mobile phone?
Mm-hmm.
What's that experience? How long does it take? You know, is there any basic information they can get on their cell phone? Can they sign up very quickly? We tend to advise our clients to make sure that they are capturing mobile phones and asking people to sign up for a data network. What we have seen is that, you know, for folks who, you know, have those cell phone networks and also have email addresses, you can double the response to an alert if you also send a text message to people.
Right, yeah. Texting still is very, it's, you get high response rates.
Right, right. You get great response rates from the text messaging, but it can also help increase, you know, the uptick in number of people who take your action online, you know,
right,
through your email.
Right.
So you get a double whammy.
Right. Voter registration work also, they found that sending people a reminder, not only about registering, but then sending them a reminder about voting actually can push up by a couple of percentage points actual turnout. It's pretty dramatic results. Okay, folks, if anybody has a question and wants to just unmute their phone and jump in, feel free. I will wait a second to see if anybody wants to do that, and if not, I've got more for Cheryl. Have no fear. All right, so Cheryl, let's talk about the Barack Obama effect. So you talked a bit about this new wave of participation, and obviously the Obama campaign did a lot of things online and merging online and offline that were pretty smart. So what is the impact? How has this changed, you know, the nature of African American participation in online politics? I mean, it seemed like it all crested last November. Is there a residue? Is there, you know, how is it changing the landscape?
Well, I think it's still early to tell, even though, you know, we're almost a year now into the Obama administration. You know, I think in the beginning there was, I know for our community, there was a lot of like, wow, well, we elected a black president. If we can go home, great. You know, and it became clear that, you know, from, you know, the far right, that there are people who, you know, were not planning to take a break. And in fact, you know, we're launching increasingly vicious and you know, racially motivated criticism of the administration. So, you know, we find a newly energized community, really. You know, we have worked hard against Glenn Beck, and now we're working on Lou Dobbs to push back on their messaging. We've worked hard on Sarah Palin and pointing out, you know, at times some of the you know, sort of race baiting that she's engaged in. So we, you know, Rush Limbaugh, you know, Sean Hannity, all of the rest of them, you know, those have been some of our primary targets and focus at this point, as well as both defending the administration and holding it accountable.
One of the things you were telling me is for big E organizations like Move On, this is also meant to change in the sort of in their membership mix, right? I mean, I assume, you know, the Color of Change has seen big growth. Move On, certainly its numbers went from somewhere between 3.5 million now to closer to 6 million. And it's younger and it's more diverse than
Absolutely.
It used to be.
Yeah, and I think that that is an important, you know, I think you've got a new generation that's really inspired by what's happening and has seen, you know, the power, you know, that they can have, you know, just by actually taking action, which is really exciting. You know, we are seeing, you know, some signs that, you know, some of the large mainline organizations like Leadership, Council for Civil Rights, and NAACP, and some of the others, CORE, are getting more interested or spending a little more energy, you know, on their web presence. But it's still, you know, I think there's still some, you know, other organizations that have, you know, a lead in how they are engaging, you know, a new generation.
Who would you point to as models?
Certainly Color of Change, Hip Hop Caucus. Reverend Lennox Yearwood has done some amazing work. They have, you know, 600,000 members.
Hip Hop Caucus.
Hip Hop Caucus, yeah.
And what Color of Change is, right?
Mm-hmm. But, you know, in their supporter database, you know, and most of those aren't in Facebook. You know, only a tiny minority of those are in Facebook. You know, they've gotten them in some other, you know, very innovative ways. So, you know, I think that it's, you know, important to, you know, I mean, if you want to know kind of, you know, the top five things, you know, you should do if you're trying to, you know, to motivate, you know, this audience, you know, and why motivate them. In many cases, they can be important constituents for, you know, for certain legislators, right? You know, if you're trying to target a certain legislator, you know, it could be that they, you know, African-American community in their district, you know, can make a difference. So the top things I think you should do is really research your audience. Don't rely on, you know, old information or, you know, sort of, you know, assumptions about how, you know, that group of people may or may not be sharing information. Even when you talk about you know, we've been talking a lot about, you know, a younger generation, you know, what I see in a lot of families, including my own, is that, you know, the older generation relies on the younger generation to help them use these tools. Even if they're not using it themselves, you know, they're getting the information, they're passing it on, you know, so, you know, I think it's important to really understand, you know, how your audience is actually, you know, communicating, you know, and sharing information. Second point, it's important to understand that there are new players and new influencers in the game, you know, that it's not just about the NAACP anymore, that there are, you know, try to figure out, you know, who's who and, you know, who's connected to whom and who, you know, are actually moving the issues that you are interested in. And then, you know, pitch appropriately. You know, go to conferences. Try to meet bloggers, you know, sponsor bloggers, you know, that with whom you want to connect and get to know, you know, bring them, you know, to your conference. Not your conference, Mija, I know you're already doing that, but, you know, if you're having, you know, a large group, you know, go ahead and you know, gathering, you know, go ahead and bring, you know, the digirati in so that, you know, they can get to know you and vice versa. Join the community. You know, a lot of, you know, there's been in the past maybe 6 months post-election, I think there's been a huge surge of, you know, black folks on Twitter. I know because they tweet me a lot. So, you know, and that goes from anywhere from, you know, superstars like Snoop Dogg to Cory Booker is very active online to, you know, just ordinary African-American citizens. So, you know, I think that there are also some listservs that are private, but depending on, you know, what kinds of work you're doing, you may be able to get access to. And I think, you know, the you know, final point is, you know, don't patronize. You know, these are folks that are, you know, often, you know, fairly sophisticated in terms of, you know, what they do and don't know, and often they can be very well connected. So, you know, ask their opinion. You know, they may have some, you know, they may be able to help you save time and avoid missteps.
Hey, Cheryl.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's Rich Robbins from AT&T. Question of, to the extent you know, how much overlap is there between the African-American community on sites like Jack and Jill Politics or the African-American bloggers and groups like Move On or readers of HuffPost or Daily Kos or other just more general online sites?
I think there's definitely some overlap. I mean, you know, we know that just because of how people share information in our open threads, and it's clear that, you know, people are reading across many different sites, including, you know, large progressive blogs, mainstream media, Huffington Post, et cetera. At the same time, I mean, one of the things that people often say that they like about our site is that we offer a variety of African-American opinions. It's not just, you know, one person, you know, or two people. You know, there's a lot of different opinions, and sometimes we actually, you know, disagree on the site. So I think that that's important to note, too, that, you know, each site has its own community that is loyal to it.
We have a question here from Amos. How much of a presence do your clients have on MySpace, and how much has this changed, in recent years?
We're definitely seeing, you know, a de-emphasis on MySpace, which, you know, I think, I don't want to say I think it's a mistake. I think that people find MySpace to be a challenging environment for organizing. At the same time, it's clear that, you know, there is a large demographic of people who are still using MySpace. So, you know, I think it's important not to ignore it. Particularly for big campaigns, we always recommend creating a MySpace presence and making sure that, you know, if nothing else, you're providing enough information that is, you know, that gets people what they need to know and points them to other ways in which they can interact with you.
Well, you were there to hear Dana Boyd's talk at PDF.
Right.
I mean, what is your view of her, you know, her argument that Facebook is growing because of a kind of digital white flight? I mean, do you think, and this sort of actually, not to just focus on her point, but, you know, you said something very interesting about a sizable chunk of your readers not being African-American, and that's always been one of the sort of one of these ongoing arguments about the web and society, which is, does it reinforce echo chambers? Do we just go to people like us, you know, who look like us or think like us? Or are we more likely to blur boundaries? It's hard to know how to answer that question. I'm sure, but and you know, I'm just wondering what your opinion is.
Yeah, here's what I would say is that, you know, people, you know, do like affinity groups, right? So you know, you are going to find sometimes that women want to talk to other women, black people want to talk to other black people. At the same time, you know, there are, you know, the lines are blurred, and I think in some cases, you know, our site is evidence that, you know, it's more blurred than maybe on some, you know, large, you know, progressive blogs where, you know, when they say that it's almost all white, right? You know,
yep.
You know, very tiny minority. So, you know, I think that there are, you know, there's some signs of encouragement there in terms of white flight. You know, I think there are a few different factors at play. One is that MySpace has mostly failed to innovate. Whereas, you know, Facebook is a lot easier to use. You know, it continues to, you know, introduce new features that are very useful to people. You know,
can I put these words in your mouth? So you're basically saying that Rupert Murdoch is a slumlord.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, you know, and I think that, you know, there you have, you know, sort of the opposite of, you know, leapfrogging there, whereby, you know, you've got a group of people who's pretty comfortable with MySpace, and they haven't seen, you know, the need yet, you know, because all of their friends are still there. They haven't seen the need yet to move over to Facebook. At the same time, you know, I think that there's something of an education and income thing that's happening there, whereby, you know, Facebook does have this, you know, college-educated patina to it, you know, as a more, you know, that kind of network. You know, I think that, you know, things are still early. You know, it's still very early to tell. And I don't know that, you know, whether it's, you know, a conscious kind of white flight, you know, as we've seen in other aspects. You know, I think we need to wait and see. I think what has happened, however, is that many organizations, because they are more comfortable with Facebook, they are focused on Facebook, and that people aren't always doing the research into, you know, who is our target audience and how are they specifically using the Internet, not just what's comfortable for me and my
people. Right. Do you think that the political blogosphere is reflective of the diversity of American life, and in particular, like, the A-list, you know, the sort of the top-trafficked, most influential blogs? I mean, this is sort of a running argument, but do you think it's gotten better over the last few years, stayed the same, gotten worse?
Well, I definitely think it's gotten better and has become much more diverse. You know, I think that, you know, I'd like to see the, you know, Latino blogs and Asian blogs continue to grow more quickly than they have, given the size of those populations. You know, I think that, you know, there has been a really rapid surge. I mean, you know, exponentially, literally, in terms of the growth in the past couple of years in African American blogs of all sizes and you know, all different shapes. I recently went to the Blogging While Brown conference, which, you know, it had not only political bloggers who happen to be African American, but also fashion, music, IT, you know, anything that you can name, cooking. You know, which was really fascinating. And, you know, what was interesting about those is that, you know, when I asked how many, one of the keynote speakers, you know, when asked, you know, how many of you sometimes talk about political issues, every single person raised their hand. So I think that is something that's important to note, particularly about minority communities, is that, you know, political, you know, and cause-related issues are something that we have to deal with every day. You know, it's something that impacts our daily lives. It's not really optional. So, you know, just because someone may be focused on a particular topic doesn't mean they can't be, you know, also a messenger for you to an important demographic that you're trying to reach.
It's a very good point. I mean, I remember hearing about lots of efforts to reach mommy bloggers during the election. Not so much about efforts to specifically reach black and brown bloggers.
Efforts were made. I think people weren't talking about it as much, but you know, certainly, you know, there was effort expended and continues to be. I think that has only grown, you know, in priority, you know, since the election and a more diverse administration.
Last chance for people on the call who may have a question. We've just got about 5 minutes left, so if you have any questions for Cheryl, now is your chance to jump in. Going once. Okay, we have a quiet group today. Cheryl, what is there a moment when you can imagine a non-identity sort of orientation to blogging for you, or is it like this is it's essential that, you know, I mean, you know, in effect, the Internet's not a melting pot, it's a salad bowl, too, right? I mean, what do you see as, you know, the role of Jack and Jill politics? What is the goal, to just continue being a focal point for a younger and more middle-class activist African-American community? That like, if you do that job well, you're happy? Or do you, is there a vision here of, well, someday race won't matter as much?
Well, you know, Glenn Beck is proof that we're not living in the post-racial America just yet.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not quite colorblind yet. I think that, you know, certainly even just over my lifetime, you know, I've seen things change, and that's probably true for most people on the phone. You know, I certainly did not ever think I would live to see a black president, and yet, you know, here we have one. So, you know, I can't predict the future. I'd be a fool in today's world to do so. At the same time, you know, I do hope that, you know, the fact that, you know, even though we, you know, target, you know, a specific group of readers and community activists, you know, that, you know, we actually appeal to a rainbow of people. And in fact, our strategy has always been diversity is not a color, it's a strength. And that, you know, we, you know, just as Obama pursued a multiracial, you know, rainbow coalition of, you know, people voting for him, and that he would not be elected if, you know, he had solely relied on black votes or solely relied on white votes, but actually had to, you know, talk to a wide variety of people in order to get elected. I think it's the same for us. And our biggest successes have been often when we have partnered with people who aren't black. You know, you know, when we've come together, you know, to work on a common goal. So, you know, I think that's, you know, where we want to continue to drive, which is to, you know, talk to our particular audience at the same time to join, you know, in coalition, you know, where we feel we can have a greater impact.
Great. Well, this has been great. Very, very interesting. Very enlightening. I want to mention to people who are listening, we are going to add to the schedule this fall a similar call with Ketty Esquivel, who does online organizing for La Raza, to talk about the changing dynamics of Latino participation online. So it'll be a nice sort of 1-2 punch to have the two of you covering this subject for us this fall. I want to really thank you, Cheryl, for taking the time to talk with us. Join us here on the PDF Network. As folks know, this call will be archived as an MP3 and available as a podcast. Two things I want to let people know about. Next week, we'll be covering measuring online advocacy and fundraising, learning from the 2009 e-nonprofit benchmark study with Mark Rubin and Karen Matheson from M&R Strategic Services. And also, we have a special offer just for PDF Network members, which you can get the details on the PDF Network homepage. This is for the digital breakfast taking place in Washington, D.C. on October 1st, next Thursday, using tech to protect content and IP. This is normally a $60 breakfast. PDF Network members can go for free. They've got a great speech. If you happen to be in Washington, D.C., you can get the details on the website. Again, thanks to AT&T and to the Bivings Group for sponsoring these calls and making the PDF Network possible. Thank you again, Cheryl, and see everybody next week on the next call. Until then, we'll see you online.